Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to the Children's Justice Project monthly training series. This training is offered to key stakeholders involved in Wyoming's juvenile court system and held every second Tuesday of the month from 12 to 1 p.m. To obtain the materials electronically for today's training, please visit the Children's Justice Project website at www.courts.state.wy.us/initiatives/CJP and then click the training tab in the middle of the screen. If there are any questions, participants are welcome to call in during the last 10 minutes of the training session. The call-in number is area code 917-889-8064. One may also post questions and comments using the online chat session on the Blog Talk Radio website. We hope you'll find today's training informative and would like to thank you for your attendance.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Edie Troutwine with the Children's Justice Project here at the Wyoming Supreme Court. Thank you for tuning in to our May Blog Talk episode. Today's episode is titled Reasonable and Prudent Parent Standard Training. And we have various presenters from the Wyoming Department of Family Services and the Wyoming Attorney General's Office. Our presenters today are as follows. We'll have Deborah Hibbard, who is a Social Services Policy and Practice Program Manager with the Department of Family Services. We also have Christy Collins Jacobson. She is a foster care coordinator in the northwest corner of the state, including Cody, Thermopolis, and Worland. We also have Brianna Montoya. She's a foster care coordinator for Albany County. Sarah Sarrelson, she is a social services analyst with the state office. Dana Ward, also a social services analyst with the Department of Family Services. And Wendy Ross from the Wyoming Attorney General's office, and she is a senior assistant attorney general there. The folks that are presenting today will be using materials that were worked on by various members across the state as well. And we also want to give credit to Brandy Edlund with the DFS Clinical Services Unit and Deanne Nelson, a foster care coordinator for Fremont County. Today's presentation will provide an overview of the Prudent Parent Standard and discuss updates to the Wyoming Department of Family Services policies. In 2014, Congress passed the Prevent Sex Trafficking and Strengthening Families Act, and this law established the Prudent Parent Standards throughout the United States. The federal legislation requires caregivers use a reasonable and prudent parent standard when determining whether to allow a child in foster care to participate in extracurricular, enrichment, cultural, and social activities. Additionally, a caregiver must be appointed to apply the reasonable and prudent standard for children who reside in congregate or institutional care. Thank you for joining us to learn more about how Wyoming has implemented the Prudent Parent Standard. And with that, I'll turn it over to Deborah Hibbard.
Hello, this is Deborah. Thank you all for joining today. As Edie mentioned, there was a great collaboration in developing this training. This training was developed for our caregivers for the state of Wyoming. We did another one for caseworkers, which was all developed last October 2016. The full training you can find on our DFS website under the foster care tab. It will provide a little bit more information than we'll present today, as we only had about an hour to present this. There are videos that are attached to the training, which are a lot of fun to review, but again, we didn't have a lot of time to go ahead and present those. So our training objectives today is to explain why normalcy is important, define what the reasonable and prudent parent standard is, describe the benefits of shared parenting, and to know how caregivers can use the reasonable prudent parent standard to determine if a child in foster care can participate in activity. Brianna Montoya will be the next to present.
Good morning. So this first section is designed to help us understand what is meant by normalcy, what it means for youth, especially those in care, and how it is at the center of the reasonable and prudent parent standard legislation. So as we're moving through these next couple of slides and talking about normalcy, I ask you to just think back to your own childhood or the childhood of friends or family. What happened after school? What did it mean to go and play with your friends? How about dating, driving, working? What things made up your childhood? So what do we mean by normalcy? Normalcy refers to age and developmentally appropriate activities and experiences that allow children and youth to grow. So essentially, it's being able to do what is considered normal or typical. Typical activities during adolescence may include going to a friend's house, taking a school trip, working an after-school job, joining an extracurricular activity, dating or driving. These are the things that I had asked you to think about. For me, I walked home every day after school with my friends. I played basketball on a city recreation team. I worked a part-time job in high school. I went on youth group out-of-town trips, and I went on dates. So these were the things that made my kind of childhood normal or typical. It is through these types of activities that youth learn about their interests and talents, how to safely experiment and take risks, practice decision-making skills, and develop healthy peer and adult relationships. And remember that testing boundaries, taking risks, asserting independence, and developing strong peer relationships are driven by normal brain development. And while those things can be worrisome or frustrating for parents and caregivers, they're essential for growth and transitioning into adulthood. Youth in foster care undergo the same developmental changes as all adolescents, and although they've experienced the trauma of being placed out of home and have likely experienced other forms of trauma, they're still undergoing those same changes and working through those same developmental stages as other children. While some youth in foster care may need special supports or extra time to navigate these experiences, they're just as critical to their growth. Oftentimes, because of real or perceived constraints, these youth are often denied the opportunity to engage in these normal activities. These constraints could come in the form of not being able to reach a caseworker in time to get permission to go on an out-of-town field trip, foster parents' or caseworkers' fears regarding liability. For example, if I say he can attend the dance, but while he's at the dance, he makes a bad decision, will the caseworker, bio parent, or judge say it's my fault for letting them go? Or just a lack of time to establish trust between the foster youth and their foster parents? We have to remember that these things can cheat a child out of their normal youthful experiences and leave them feeling powerless and left behind. Besides meeting developmental milestones, there are other advantages to providing normalcy for youth in foster care. For example, providing youth the opportunity to develop healthy and supportive relationships in the community through these different activities improves the youth's chance at permanency. For example, here in Laramie, we had a young man who had joined the high school football team. He developed a really strong bond with the football coach, and the coach and his wife became certified foster parents and provided him a loving home throughout his time in high school. And he still goes back to their home during college breaks and vacations. Additionally, prioritizing the development of connections for youth in care can improve their resilience and competencies in many areas. And this just goes back to helping youth feel as though they're not powerless. While youth in foster care aren't in a normal situation per se, caregivers play a vital role in facilitating the normalcy that's so critical to their development and well-being. There is a link in your handout on slide number 4 to a short clip which encompasses everything we've just talked about in these last two slides, so feel free to view that when you have a chance. And I'm now going to turn it over to Wendy Ross with the AG's office.
Hi, this is Wendy. I'm with the AG's office, and I am going to walk you guys through the law part behind this. As Edie said, when we started the Preventing Sex Trafficking and Strengthening Families Act, is where this reasonable and prudent parent standard comes from. This was passed by Congress in 2014 and had a bunch of stuff in it, including this standard. And then in 2016, the Wyoming legislature enacted legislation to conform the state law to the federal law and regulations. So in 2016, House and Rule Act 41 created a reasonable and prudent parent standard chapter in Title 14, and it includes a definition for what the reasonable and prudent parent standard is. And it defines the standard in Wyoming Statute 14.13.101A, Romanet 6, as careful and sensible parental decisions that maintain the health, safety, well-being, and best interests of a child while encouraging the emotional and developmental growth of the child. And then further in that section, Wyoming Statute, or in that chapter, I mean, Wyoming Statute 14.13.102 provides that, subject to certain restrictions, a child in an out-of-home placement is entitled to engage in, to the greatest extent possible, age-appropriate or developmentally appropriate activities and experiences as he would otherwise be able to experience in his own home. And this goes back to that normalcy that we just talked about. And so when determining whether a child should be allowed to participate in an activity, the caregiver should be using the reasonable and prudent parent standard. So under Wyoming law, the factors that a caregiver should consider, and for those of you who are following along with the PowerPoint, we're on slide 7 now. But the factors that the caregiver should consider under this standard are, first, a parent or custodian's wishes when appropriate. Sometimes it may not be appropriate for various reasons. We should also consider the child's age, maturity, and development level to make sure that the activity is going to be safe for the child. We need to look at the potential risk factors and appropriateness of the activity or experience for the child. We should also be looking at the best interest of the child based on information known by the caregiver at that time. Of course, we should also be considering the child's wishes, whether or not the child wants to participate in this activity. We should look at the importance of encouraging the child's emotional and developmental growth. Would this activity support that? We should also look at the importance of supporting the child in developing skills to successfully transition to adulthood. So a different consideration to look at when we're looking at activities for some older children. We should also look at the importance of providing the child with the most family-like living experience possible. And then finally, we should also look at any special needs or accommodations that the child may need to be able to safely participate in the activity or experience. And then further under that same statute, it provides that a caregiver's ability to provide or withhold permission shall not override or conflict with a parent's residual parental rights and duties. It shall be exercised using the reasonable and prudent parent standard, which was previously defined. It shall not conflict with any applicable court order or department case plan, and may be exercised without the prior approval of the department if the caregiver is exercising the authority consistent with the department's case plan. And then another important piece is that under Wyoming law, there is a limitation of liability in the statute, saying that the caregiver won't be liable for harm caused to a child as the result of the child's participation in an activity or experience approved by the caregiver, so long as the caregiver complies with the reasonable and prudent parent standard and exercises it according to the statute. So I just talked a little bit about that exercising this standard and making these decisions shouldn't conflict with residual parental rights. So residual parental rights and duties mean those rights and duties that remain with the parents after legal custody, guardianship of the person, or both have been given to another person or agency, such as the department. And so there's a statute that talks about what some of those residual parental rights and duties are. And as always, it says includes but not limited to, and it lists things like the duty to support the child. It also talks about the right to consent to adoption, the right to reasonable visitation unless that visitation has been restricted or prohibited by court order, the right to determine the minor's religious affiliation, and the right to petition on behalf of the minor. So when we're looking at a caregiver exercising a decision under this reasonable and prudent parent standard, we need to make sure that they are not conflicting with any residual parental rights that the parent has. And so generally the areas that you might see conflict between exercising the reasonable and prudent parent standard and residual parental rights, I think, are generally going to fall under conflicts with visitation and conflicts with religious activities. And conflicts that might arise under visitation, the activities that a child may be participating in may conflict with scheduled visitation, and so we always want to make sure that we're considering when trying to make a decision on whether a child should participate in an activity, whether or not that conflicts with visitation with the parents or siblings. And then religious activities, the parents still have that right to direct the child's religious affiliation. So if it's a religious activity, we want to make sure that that is something that's okay with the parent. And if the parent says no, then we're probably not going to be letting that child do that activity because that right still belongs to the parent. So I'm done with the law portion now, and I'm going to turn it over to Christy Collins-Jacobson.
Hi, all. I'm Christy, like she said, and I'm a foster care coordinator up here in the north part of the state. And right now, I'm going to cover two slides. It will be slide 11 and 12, and we should be on co-parenting / shared parenting. We wanted to, we thought it was important that you guys all heard some of what we taught the foster parents. And when we did the reasonable and prudent parenting training for them, we stressed the importance of birth parent involvement with their children while they were in foster care. And we wanted to really let them know how critical co-parenting is and that it's an important part of providing care for a child while they're in foster care. And we let them know that we understood it can be a difficult part of being a foster parent, but it's worth the effort. We acknowledge that there can be sometimes obvious gaps between caregivers and parents and birth parents. These gaps can be real or perceived, but at the same time, showing support for birth families can be simple. It can be simple in ways like including their including the parent in their child's progress at school or encouraging the parent in their parenting efforts, showing respect for a birth parent through actions or finding other creative ways to help keep the birth parent connected with their child and or youth. We let foster parents know that we appreciate all their efforts to build relationship with the birth parents. Caregivers frequently do a lot to help build relationships with the child's parents, such as just greeting a parent with a smile, asking a parent for advice on their child's likes or dislikes, including them so that they can attend doctor's appointments or school activities, sharing photos or artwork or other keepsakes with the parents, and just keeping them informed and involved in their child's life as much as possible. We did a short list of some of the benefits of developing a relationship with a child's parents. Reducing what we thought we wanted to highlight for them is reducing, it can help reduce discord between families. It promotes the child having better self-esteem. It can cut down on manipulation and may increase acting out. It can lessen the incidence of allegations of child abuse or neglect against the foster parents. Help the caregiver gain a better understanding of where the child and the parents come from. It helps the child to see everyone getting along. They know that many people love them and it's okay to be happy. A positive relationship makes communication and contact more likely after the child goes home. And in general, it just makes being a foster parent much easier. MDT members can help and support foster parents to form and build relationship with birth families. Here's a couple ways. We all can talk positively about the birth parents and the foster family. And we can support the foster parents when they set their boundaries, such as, you know, well, sometimes foster parents can have big hearts, which can lead them to overextend themselves, as we all probably have experienced. MDT members can help them by setting clear visitation plans, phone contact. We can respect respect and show foster parents that we respect their schedule. MDT members can also support foster parents in their interactions with other professionals. And finally, just understanding, help the foster parents understand court procedures or permanency goals. A couple ways we can build relationships with the birth parents right away and then throughout the case are icebreaker meetings and bridging the gap. An icebreaker meeting is usually held at the beginning of a case and can help reduce the trauma of a foster care placement. It can improve everyone's ability to help the child in this transition. An icebreaker meeting is usually a caseworker-facilitated conversation between the birth and the foster parents. And sometimes the child or youth can make contributions in this meeting too. Some of the things discussed at this first meeting can be the child's likes and dislikes, their routines, allergies, or other medical information, important people in the child's life, and a discussion of practical things that the child might need. Bridging the gap is the other item that we wanted to talk about. That is not necessarily a one-time thing or a program. It's just all those little things that we do and those creative ideas we put into place to keep the parents connected, informed, and involved. So it's all those things we kind of just talked about: showing support, including parents, encouraging them, showing respect, and finding ways to maintain those relationships that we build. Okay, and with that, that's the end of my part, and I'll turn it over to Sarah.
Hi, everyone. This is Sarah Sarrelson. So another important component is involving youth, and I am on slide 13 at this point. A question that often arises about youth is, when should youth be involved in decisions? Involving children in tough discussions should be based on their development, therapeutic, and situational appropriateness. Allowing children some involvement may include having the child voice their desires, allowing the child choices in decision making, discussing with the child why something is not allowed or why something is going to be allowed. Communication allows children to have a sense of control over their experience in foster care and provides the child with value in situations that directly involve them. Children of school age and above should be involved in case planning, and case planning with an older youth may include discussions related to activities, family contact, or discussions in relation to safety, permanency, and well-being. We have some reminders about things to remember when having difficult conversations with children. It's important to understand and believe the importance of giving children a say in decisions that affect them. We want to have realistic expectations about a child's participation, based on their developmental appropriateness. You'll want to evaluate your participation method for the children and may be able to make adaptations based on their needs. We want to make sure children understand their role in the process and that their participation is voluntary. Respecting children's views, we want to recognize children, like adults, may have different views about an issue and appreciate those individual views. It's important to be honest and upfront about our limits and boundaries and acknowledge different culture and values while we're addressing specific needs of children with disabilities. Some potential barriers to children's participation include thinking that children lack the experience to participate, not valuing children's views, a lack of resource and time, thinking it's not appropriate to involve children in decision-making, not knowing how to contact children, concerns about safety and ethics, thinking that children don't want to participate, language and/or cultural barriers, not knowing how to involve children and how to discuss issues with them, thinking that the processes are too complex or too time-consuming, and also financial constraints. So with that in mind, there are various techniques to engaging children, and additional information is available on the online version of the full training. But at this point, I want to turn it over to Dana Ward.
Thanks, Sarah. I'm Dana Ward. I'm responsible for the foster care program for the state. I'm a social services program analyst. Another part of the training that we did for foster parents, we really wanted to talk about trauma and its impact on child development. So I'll be covering, I'm at slide 15 right now. Children who experience traumatic events may show a range of reactions, and such reactions could include hyperarousal, re-experiencing the trauma, so this can make the child feel like they're back in the trauma again, avoidance or withdrawal, where the children may withdraw from friends or activities and may disassociate to protect themselves. And a child's response to traumatic events will vary depending on several factors. One factor is the child's age and their developmental stage. So in your PowerPoint presentation, we have a number of charts based on the ages of the child. We'll just go over the first one to kind of give you an example of how to use the charts. So when we think about a child's development, it's really important to keep in mind that children with a history of trauma develop at a different rate than children who have not experienced trauma. The charts on slide 16 through 19 show the expected development for a child in a specific age range and then how trauma the child has experienced can impact their physical, cognitive, and social or emotional development. So for the example of infants and toddlers for birth to age 2, some important tasks for them physically include gaining control of muscles, balance, coordination, and stability, learning to lift their head, roll over, crawl, pull up, walk, and grasp toys. Cognitively, they're beginning to recognize people and objects. They're understanding language, and they begin to say words in simple sentences. And then social and emotionally, they begin to attach to the caregiver. They start developing a trusting relationship. They start to have an ability to have simple interactions with others through play and games, and they begin to learn right and wrong as well as good and bad. If the child has experienced trauma physically, their learning could be delayed. Practicing fine motor skills could be limited. Exploring their world could be limited or could be something really scary. Cognitively, the ability to focus and concentrate could be limited. Difficulty with language association, such as understanding words and having speech delays, may be common. And then socially and emotionally, it limits the ability to make positive attachments and trusting relationships. The trauma could have an increase amount of anxiety and fear of others, and it could interfere with the child's ability to socially interact with others. And it limits their ability to form a positive sense of self. This gives you an idea of how to use the chart, so you can review the charts on slide 17 through 19 on your own. On slide 20, there's a link to a short video, and you can watch that at another time, but the video is an example of how developmental age may be different than chronological age. On slide 21, during our pre-service training for foster parents, we introduced the concept of a jigsaw puzzle. And that example is on slide 21. And as we've discussed, foster children are often at different developmental stages than what you would expect to see based on their chronological age. So this blank one can be useful in helping to identify where a child is developmentally, emotionally, and socially. So if you look at slide 22, this is an example of what you would expect to see in a jigsaw puzzle for a 17-year-old who was raised in a stable and nurturing home. On slide 23 is an example of a child who's experienced trauma or might be in foster care. Is Jane. She's Caucasian, and she's a 17-year-old female. She's a senior in high school. So under the chronological age, we have 17. For her background, Jane was taken into protective custody at age 6. For placements, she was home until the age of 6, and then she moved into foster care, to relative foster care, and then to residential treatment, back to foster care, and then to therapeutic foster care. So she jumped around and had a total of 7 placements. In her current family, one parent is Caucasian, the other is Native American and Caucasian. Jane was placed with this family at the age of 12. Some of the behaviors she displayed included sexual acting out, lying, stealing, physical aggression towards caregivers and younger peers, and destroying property. For her social and developmental struggles with social interactions with peers in her own age, she tends to revert to the age of the youngest peer she is around, is charming to adults until they address any misbehavior, then she's defiant and avoids any relationships with them. She's also very self-centered and lacks any empathy for others. She frequently lies and refuses to take ownership over any behaviors. She's often mistaken for younger than her age, as she has poor hygiene and doesn't take care of her hair and wears clothing that younger children would normally wear. Educationally, Jane has an average IQ. She was placed on an IEP in elementary due to her behaviors at school, but does not currently have one. Now, as a senior in high school, she's an A student, and she doesn't participate in any after-school activities. So let's place her on the jigsaw puzzle, knowing this information. So we know that she's age 7. For her appearance, her age is, we would just write in that she's 12 to 15. Her gender is female. She's identifying as female. Her sexual orientation is heterosexual. Her emotional age is 12. The social age is 12. Her cognitive age ranges from 12 to 17. She matches with the ethnically with the family that she's placed with. She's currently had 5 years of tradition with that family, so we just write in 5 in that area. Her school age is 17, IQ-wise, and is a senior. And her life experience ranges from 10 to 17. So on slide 24, we've talked about the importance of normalcy, some ideas to strengthen relationships with kids' parents, reasons to include children and youth in the decision-making process, and a brief overview of how trauma can impact child development and decisions a caregiver might make in using the reasonable and prudent parent standard. In this section, we'll look at different scenarios, the application of the law, and DFS policies regarding making reasonable and prudent parent decisions. So this particular slide gives you links to different resources that we'll be covering. And this section, please refer to the Caregiver Guideline for Reasonable and Prudent Parent Standards summary. It's the first link on the slide. So as we go through the various scenarios, what you'll want to do is look at your summary handout and consider the following questions. Is the activity in the child's best interest, and will it promote the child to use emotional, social, and or developmental growth? Will this activity violate a court order, parental rights, the safety plan, case plan, or treatment plan? Will this activity violate agency policy? What are the parents' wishes? Will the timing of this activity interfere with sibling or parental visitation, counseling, or a doctor's appointment? Would I allow my own child to participate in this activity? Does the youth want to participate in the activity? Do they have any other concerns about participating in the activity? Other questions might be, what are the potential risk factors and appropriateness of the activity or experience? Are there any special needs or accommodations that the child may need to safely participate in the activity or experience? Has the child shown maturity in decision-making that is appropriate for his or her age and ability? So in the first scenario, we have a 15-year-old foster daughter who comes home with a permission slip to try out for the school soccer team. If she makes the team, she will be required to attend practice every day after school for 3 to 4 months. Once the season begins, she will have games 1 to 2 evenings per week, some at home and some in other communities around the state. Her grades are mostly B's and C's. She has a visit with her parents once each week and a counseling appointment every other week. The foster parents don't enjoy athletics, and your children and their children did not play team sports in high school, so they're not familiar with what's involved. So in looking at that scenario, there's really a lot of things to consider, but the most important thing is, what will the youth gain? Making friends, developing socially, and being a part of the group will outweigh any inconvenience. In going through the checklist, there did not appear to be any restrictions, so now we need to think about how to make it work, especially if the foster parents are considering saying no because they don't have time. Also, since it may interfere with counseling, visits with parents, and the caregiver's schedule, this is something the caregiver will want to discuss with the parents and possibly cover with the rest of the multidisciplinary team. Consider whether or not the parents can attend games and help with transportation to practices, or who else can help with transportation. Maybe other soccer parents or family members. Can counseling appointments be scheduled around practice and games? Does the team know anything else that needs to be taken into consideration? What else needs to happen so the youth is supported in participating in the activity? This decision-making process is similar to what the caregiver would do for their own child. Unless there's a liability waiver on the permission slip for the tryout, the foster parents would probably be able to sign it after they've considered everything required to apply the reasonable and prudent parent standard. In the second scenario, we have a foster family planning a 2-week vacation to several national parks. They want to bring the whole family, including their children who are 8 and 10 and their foster children, 2 brothers who are 9 and 11. The boys generally have a visit with their family every week, and they have a strong relationship with their mom, who's making progress on her case plan. The caseworkers told the foster family the boys will probably be reunified with their mom by around the time school starts back in the fall. The boys are each 1 grade behind in school. They have no significant health problems and no major behavior problems. So when going through the checklist, the reasonable and prudent parent standard does not apply because the trip will be out of state and it's for more than 2 nights. The foster family will need to discuss this with the parent and get prior approval from DFS. This doesn't mean they can't work something out. It just doesn't fall under the reasonable and prudent parent standard. If the brothers do go on vacation with the foster family will probably be applying the reasonable and prudent parent standard with other activities throughout the trip. In the third scenario on slide 29, we have an 11-year-old foster daughter who would like to spend the night at her friend's house. She occasionally wets the bed, but hasn't had an accident in the last 3 months. She also has a history of night terrors, but has never had a night terror since being placed with the current caregiver. The caregiver has known the friend's parents, Don and Sally Green, for years and has allowed their own children to spend the night at their home. So does this fall under the reasonable and prudent parent standard? And in reviewing the checklist, it does. So the caregiver can make the decision by applying the reasonable and prudent parent standard. Some of the things they may want to consider is the visit is only for one night, so the caregiver just needs to notify the caseworker. She hasn't had an accident in a while, but the caregiver may want to talk to her about whether or not she wants to wear a pull-up or just kind of talk through on how to handle it if she does have an accident. The caregiver will need to complete the respite form and give a copy of it to the Greens as well. On slide 30, we have scenario four. So a 17-year-old foster son wants to apply for a part-time job at the neighborhood fast food restaurant. He's lived in the caregiver's home for 1 month. He has never had a job before. His school grades are good, and so far he's had no behavioral issues. He has no birth family involvement. So in reviewing the checklist, this does fall under a decision the caregiver can make using the reasonable and prudent parent standard. Some of the things that the caregiver may want to consider include he's only lived in the foster home for a month, so the foster family doesn't know him real well, and he's never had a job before. So in this case, the foster parent might want to consult with the caseworker. The independent living coordinator for their area may be able to provide ongoing support as well. And then the last scenario that we have is on slide 31, and this would be an alternate care or non-respite arrangement. So the caregivers are going out of town for the weekend. They will be leaving Saturday morning and returning late Sunday evening. They typically leave their children with their parents, Grandma and Grandpa Jones, when they go out of town without the kids. What steps do the caregivers need to take for the foster children to also stay with the caregiver's parents? So in reviewing the checklist, this does fall under the reasonable and prudent parent standard because the parents live in town and it's not for more than 2 nights. The caregiver would need to notify the caseworker of where they will be staying and complete and provide a copy of the respite form to the grandparents. So what are some of the factors you might want to consider when making the decision? One of them might be, do the children have any behaviors the grandparents need to be aware of? And can the grandparents handle the behaviors? And what supervision level is required? It may be different than what the grandparents might typically expect. Slide 32 has a list of resources that have more information you can refer to as you want. And that concludes our presentation. We really appreciate your participation in the training today. And I'll turn it over to Edie to see if she has any questions for any of us.
Thank you, Dana, and thank you to everybody who presented. So we've opened up the chat line, so if you have a question, please type it in, and also we have the phone lines open. Well, we don't have any questions coming in yet, Dana, but does anybody else that's presented have any sort of closing thoughts or statements that they would like to leave us with today? Dana, do you have any messages out there for foster parents or anybody working in the legal system just when they think about reasonable and prudent parent standards?
I don't have anything to add, but if anybody has any questions, please feel free to contact any of us. If they want to contact the local foster care coordinator in their area, And I don't think, I haven't heard about us having any problems that have arisen as a, you know, since we've implemented the reasonable and prudent parent standard. I think everybody's done really good in working through anything that's come up. So, and also just want to point out that May is National Foster Care Month, and I'd really like to say a huge thank you to everyone in the legal system who helps the youth in care as well as in supporting foster parents. You make a world of difference, and in so many ways that we often don't know. So thank you so much for all the work you do.
Well, all right. Well, thank you, everyone, and thank you to all the listeners that tuned in today. And just as a reminder, this was supposed to be our last Blog Talk episode of the year. However, back in April, we attempted to do a 2017 Wyoming case law update, including some recent Wyoming Supreme Court decisions and legislation. And those presenters only got through the 2016 update, so we are planning to have a 30-minute Blog Talk episode probably later into the summer to hit some of those 2017 Supreme Court decisions. So stay tuned for that. So even though it appears on our website that that today was our last episode, we are planning a special episode sometime this summer. So thank you again to everyone, and have a great rest of your day.